Good evening and welcome to Yellow Dogs. Tonight I'd like to start with a quote from Albert Einstein. He says, "A new type of thinking is essential if mankind is to survive and move towards higher levels." Interesting, huh? And then I remember I read it this week, and then I looked for it for my lesson, and I couldn't find it, but I Googled it. But I remember that he says that our mind is connected to three ways the mind operates. He said, the rational mind that we all understand. Then he says there's the creative mind, and you know, we kind of know all about the creative mind. And then he says the imaginative mind. And so creativity, he says, is commonly referred to as the ability to create something real using the imagination, whereas imagination is the capability to create in one's own mind what does not exist. So the imagination comes first and is necessary for creativity, but not the other way around. So Einstein gives imaginative a higher knowing of the mind. Just like childlike. Though we know that. We've touched that place. And then we have William James, who always reminds us that there are other types of consciousness or ways of knowing, which are discontinuous with our rational mind. And it's screened from us by the veil of our attachment to our rational mind. Let me say that again. William James pointed us to other types of consciousness or ways of knowing, which are discontinuous with our rational mind, and screened from us by the veil of our attachment to the rational mind. So understanding the nature of the rational mind is most important. And he cautioned man against prematurely closing his accounts with reality before he had incorporated these other ways of knowing. So that's what we're doing. We're learning about the nature of the mind as we become still and quiet. And then in that stillness, call it whatever you want to, but there is this spaciousness in the mind that arises where we feel bigger than big. It's spacious. So we experience the spaciousness that frees us from the rational mind. And we've all experienced that if we've meditated. So a mind that has everything to do with happiness, that's awareness. That's the spacious mind. But it seems like the mind that we are attached to or that we use the most traps us in its tyranny. And we create these issues of tyranny ourselves. So If that's true and we are responsible for its tyranny, then studying the nature of the mind, we realize the mind can be retrained. And we begin to see for ourselves that we don't have to stay trapped in these hellish mind states. So when we follow this path of mindfulness, we begin to see how we get trapped. And that's important, because mindfulness seems to free us from the trivia of life that we get so bogged down with. And with the freedom of identifying with just our bodies and mind. And that's not all. Teaches us about the true nature of feelings that we get bogged down on. Emotions that we don't quite understand their true nature, so they take over. But once we sincerely study all of this phenomena, which that's all it is phenomena that we all share, then something shifts. And so whenever we meditate, the rational mind is there, of course. So, and it can be very frustrating. And the Buddha knew that. And so he said, well, look out. There are five hindrances to look for that is going to occur in anyone who is meditating, regardless how long you've meditated. So, the five hindrances: desire, wanting. We're going to talk about, go deeper into exactly what the desire is meant in this context. Aversion, pushing away, restlessness, sloth and torpor, or laziness, and doubt. And of course, nothing's wrong with these because of the fact we all experience them. They're part of us. But the reason they're so important to understand in our meditation is that they can be misunderstood and take us away from the practice. So you can see why it's so important. And some of us who have practiced a little longer, we're well acquainted with these five hindrances. And not that they don't come up, they certainly do. But understanding their true nature, they don't grab us as much. I mean, I certainly still get lost in sleepiness and restlessness. I certainly do. But somehow, there's a remembering. Oh, yeah, this is something that the Buddha said to look for. So it is the mind that's full of wanting, or the mind that's full of pushing away, not wanting, or a mind that's so restless. And do we not all have a restless mind? Well, look at our environment. There's just restlessness everywhere. And then sloth and torpor, the traditional terms, but the lack of energy to see what that's all about. And doubt, oh, this practice is not doing anything. I've been practicing for a long time and it's doing nothing. So I say to you, because this is what my teachers have said to me, after a while, after you've meditated for a while, ask someone. Usually they will tell you, yeah, I'm kind of seeing a difference. Now it varies what the difference is, but before you see it, others see it. And then we begin to see it in ourselves. Tar Brock calls them energies. And that's all they are. And Sharon Salzberg, in her happiness book, calls them greedy, grumpy, anxious, slothful, doubt. So there's an ongoing joke in Buddhist circles that we can have these all at once. It's called a multiple hindrance attack. We all can relate to it. And when they come up in our practice, if we don't know what to do with them, then they will take us away from the clarity of the present moment, which is exactly what we're practicing. Looking clearly. And if we don't notice them, they'll overwhelm us. We'll get lost. So the wanting, it's a beautiful time. This is things we want to see for ourselves, experience for ourselves anyway. And in the meditation practice, it's important to recognize wanting. Wanting. It's important to recognize pushing away, don't want. It's important to recognize these things, even though we're talking as if they are just attached to the meditation practice, but we begin to see it in our everyday life. And they're distracting. They're distracting because they can take over and leave us from living fully 100% in the present moment. So they can be quite strong, especially if you happen to be at a retreat, but it doesn't matter where you're sitting all day, they are certain to come. But the more we practice, of course, the better we get to know them. And they are not as compelling as they have. But at the beginning, if we don't know these energies, you can see how it's going to take us away. Because we're so unsure anyway about this practice at the beginning. So they keep us from being fully present. And my teacher said they're just to be known, not judged, and just to be honored for what they are. And so their mind states that come and go all the time. Very noticeable in sitting, in our sitting meditation when we're quiet and still. But they can cause a lot of suffering if we don't know how to work with them. So this comes through, those five energies come through our thoughts or a sensation or emotion. And so again, it allows us to see the truth of the thoughts and emotions and sensations, feelings that come and go. And the more we see them like this, the more we realize that they're not who we are and that they can be managed. We're not going to get rid of them. We couldn't even if we wanted to get rid of them. But we do want to acknowledge them. And how we work with them, how we meet them, will determine the level of suffering that they will bring. So let's look at desire. And again, nothing is wrong with desire. It's a very natural phenomena. And as I've said to you many, many times, our first time that we go through the six senses, we are going to automatically, naturally like, dislike, or not notice. And that's okay. It's a very natural phenomena. But it's what we do at that point that can create suffering. So, of course, we want things to go our way, and nothing's wrong with that. But we know also it's not going to happen. And so we have created habits or behaviors that we have come up with our own in dealing with them. Because I desire for my desires to be met. It's in me. And when they're not satisfied, what do I do next? And that's what we want to look at, not to judge ourselves or think something's wrong with us, but to get to know them. So we all have runaway stories, how we run away from things that are happening within. We go to the refrigerator. I love to go to chocolate. But we can go to our iPhones, the TV. We even go to a novel. If we don't allow the sacred pause to arise where we can choose to rain on them. The acronym RAIN, recognizing them, allowing them, becoming interested in them, and knowing that following those three steps that they will nurture us, nurture exactly what we're trying to do. So this tool helps us to experience for ourselves in a very intimate way. And we're grieving when we don't get our way. And so it's okay to look at it in that way because it's a loss. We have expectations and, you know, they're not going to be met. And so we grieve the loss. We might not see it in that term, and not that you have to. But if it's not being heard or known, it grows, it multiplies, it becomes more intense. And this type of suffering can be managed. That's what meditation's all about. So really the first thing we can do is just look at what we're doing with all our disappointments. And as you well know, that happens all day long. Many, many times with a whole range of the little things in life along with bigger issues in life. Little ones and big ones. And I've told you before, it doesn't always happen, but the practice has enabled me to see my aversion over the simple things of my daily life. And it's most helpful, because when I see this aversion of not thinking it's more important than anything else, then I get caught. And we feel the pain of loss, which is fine. And it is the law of nature. But how to learn with our disappointments is like everything else that we learn about life. Because knowing them, allowing them, looking at them, bringing them into our consciousness allows them not to grab us. They're not going to go away necessarily, but they could, because I've noticed in the things I push away, little things like standing at the refrigerator waiting for that slow-mo cold water to become in my glass. It's been so annoying, you know. But then there's an opportunity, because I began to see, you know, I'm going to do it. Do I have a choice? And I have to say that it took quite a while to ease into it, but I don't have the resistance in my body that hurts. And you know, we get this idea, we departmentalize our life saying, well, this moment is more important than that moment. And if I'm brushing my teeth, or if I'm going to the bathroom, whatever I'm doing, that's not important. I can be unconscious. But no, that's how we build consciousness. That's how we connect to consciousness, not just when we're on the cushion, but when we are living our daily lives. How are we meeting these desires, these wants? So I can remember before meditation, and Randy certainly can too, can remember when little things, as little as breaking something, that I cherish. And of course I feel the loss, but my goodness, it used to could ruin my whole day, and along with Randy's probably. And I wore the grief way too long. There was this attachment to an object. I didn't want it to go. So, wallowing in the wallowing. Oh, but that was an antique, you don't understand. That was given to my mother by her great aunt, who was quite famous for something. But it doesn't matter that it came from the thrift store. We have just put so much value in it. And yet we understand it's as fleeting as everything else in our lives. So we have given it much authority. And we set ourselves up, even over the small desires of breaking things, making a mistake, saying something stupid, doing it wrong. See how we load ourselves? Some things that how we relate to them. We invest these emotions and we remember them, and attaching to them builds the emotion. So it doesn't free us from the emotion. It just gets stronger if we don't know what to do with it. I was with a young friend the other day, and she said something really profound. We were kind of talking about all the trivial pains that we're going through. And truly, we can make our desire for objects seem like a tragedy. But she said to us, "Gee, you guys, that's a first world problem that you just made into a tragedy."
Like water from your refrigerator.
Like water from my refrigerator. Oh, yes. Boy, I loved it. Just, you know, just woke me up. Yeah. How we get attached emotionally and everything else to the trivial things in life, where all around us there's occurring real tragedies. People are losing their homes, families, safety, food. Now, those are tragedies. But breaking something in my possession can't even compare to that, unless I understand its true nature. So, desire turns into greed, manifests into greed. And it can come in many forms and can be very trivial. And so desire leads to greed that leads to suffering. What does the Buddha say? Greed, hatred, and delusion. Those are our traps. Greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's under one umbrella I'm talking about, but it's huge if we elaborated on all three of them. So, with a spacious view, we can open up to these trances we get in of our habit in a big mind way. But after we, oh dear, I didn't look at my time. My goodness. Okay. I just got so carried away. I want to say the antidotes to these. The antidotes to grasping. One of them is a sense of gratitude, wanting, looking at what we already have. And this young friend, that's one of the things she brought up. You know, yeah, let's look what we have instead of wallowing what, you know, what is not happening in our lives. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you for being good listeners. And we are going to, this is a series on all five hindrances, and we'll go deeper in each one, because sometimes just saying the words, we somehow don't get the deep meaning or the deep understanding of the effects that it has on us in a very daily way. Thank you.